Hisham, in 91, the Madrid conference took place. Where were you then, and how did you view what was happening?
Yeah, Mark, I was a professor of political science at University of North Dakota in Grand Forks, North Dakota.
Oh, not far from my origins in Duluth, Minnesota.
Yes, indeed. And I was there in North Dakota for just like, 2 months. And it was getting absolutely cold then by late October. And snow started to fall in November. But as the Madrid conference was convened, of course, this was a major piece of news for us to keep up with. And my immediate reaction to it was one of skepticism.
Now, I was here in Washington. We met somewhere around this time when you walked up to me at a conference in Washington. I don't think either of us remember the exact day, the exact conference or time, but it was right around now, right around this time. The Gulf War had taken place the year before, the first Gulf War. The Intifada was still ongoing. I think the Palestinian Intifada was still considered, people were talking about the Intifada still. So why were you so skeptical at the distance you were? You weren't able to be home. What was it that caused you to say, gee, I'm pretty skeptical about this?
There were a number of reasons, Mark. Number one, I was not convinced that the Bush administration, which led the war on Iraq, the very devastating, brutal war on Iraq in January, February 1991, could be the same broker of peace between Palestinians and Israelis, between Arabs and Israelis, as they wanted to project in the Madrid conference. So that in itself, I mean, the war that the Bush administration launched really created very profound frustration in me and in many, many Arabs who saw the extent of the assault on, Iraq, the destruction of the country. Of course, Iraq's invasion of Kuwait notwithstanding. That was number one.
Of course, there's a whole issue there, too, whether or not Saddam was kind of tricked into that, but that's not for this book. That's been written about in other books, including by Pierre Salinger, the former the former White House press secretary.
Absolutely.
Now,
Number two. When the Palestinians were asked or invited, if you will, to go to Madrid, they were never invited to go as an independent delegation equal to other delegations that participated in the talks. They were a part of the joint Jordanian-Palestinian delegation. And to me, that meant an infringement on Palestinian independence right there from the start. Number three.
Which was exactly the message that the Americans and the Israelis wanted to send to everybody.
Absolutely.
That the Palestinians aren't a nation, that they're not entitled to self-determination. They're, in fact, connected to other Arab states, and in this case, Jordan.
Well, exactly. I mean, this was absolutely the beginning. This was the introduction that whatever Palestinians would get out of these talks would not be independence. It would always be some form of an entity that would be under the control of some other. And here we are in the year, 2011, and indeed, up until today, the Palestinians do not have any real independence whatsoever. They are under the control of the Israelis. Number three, in the summer of 91, I was in Palestine. And, I saw the Intifada still unfolding. But on the other hand, I also saw the beginnings for the rise of, a local trend in the occupied territories by, in my view, pseudo-intellectuals. Intellectuals who were searching for a role for themselves in the Intifada. That is, intellectuals who might represent the aristocracy in Palestinian society, that was always isolated, that has nothing to do with the profound concerns of the people who were out of touch with Palestinian, you know, real grievances and pain. Yet, nonetheless, they were searching for a role for themselves. And when the, you know, whole saga of the Madrid conference unfolded, I was in constant touch with people there, the, you know, difficulties of communication notwithstanding. And I got the impression that, number one, those who would participate in the delegations were not necessarily what, you know, Palestinians would really want to see as representatives, perhaps except, you know, the head of the delegation, Dr. Haider Abdeshafi, who was always considered a very dignified, a decent, you know, person. But on the other hand, so, you know, some people were trying to go to Madrid, you know, left and right. I mean, those who just want a way out, you know, even for a trip, they were, you know, joining the delegation. That meant that some of these people had to make compromises, you know, for the Israelis, had to sacrifice certain principles because the Israelis would not authorize, would not grant anybody, especially at that time, at the height of the Intifada, a permit, a travel permit to leave the country without some dues. And to me, that was worrisome. And I knew some of the people who, you know, went to Madrid, and I knew that they were not even qualified.
Well,
anyway whatsoever.
In later years, I came to know Dr. Abdeshafi very well, and before he died, I did a long 3-hour interview with him in which he told me his whole story in detail. I've never published it. It's in my video collection. But you were there in the summer of 91. I was there a few months later, just before the Madrid conference, and the reason I remember it is I don't think you and I had met quite yet. We must have met in the months ahead in Washington. But I remember I was sitting, you didn't mention his name, but I'm sure you're referring to him, I was sitting in the offices of Al-Quds newspaper in Jerusalem with the publisher, Abu Zuloff, and with Saeb Arakat, who now, 20 years later, is still the quote-unquote chief negotiator after all kinds of scandals and resignations and everything else. So there I was sitting with them, and I can distinctly remember how his phone rang, and he said he must take the call. I still don't know who it was on the other end. I don't know if it was Arafat calling from Tunis or if it was somebody calling from Ramallah, but when he put down the phone, he said, I've just been told I'm on the Madrid delegation. I must go. Literally, they were leaving in the next couple of days, I think. Absolutely, I had the same uneasy feeling, but nowhere near the depth because you're part of that society. But I knew there's something not right here, the way this is being organized. I also did not trust at all Baker and Bush, the remnants of the Reagan administration. And in those days, we didn't really call them that, but the neocons were already taking power, and the Israeli Jewish lobby was extremely powerful, and it has grown in power year after year. So we had pretty much the same reaction. Now, when Madrid took place, I'm sure you were following it as intensely as you could from North Dakota, from the snows of North Dakota. And how did you evaluate it at the time?
Well, just to say one last word, as a matter of fact, you know, to me, the Madrid conference was a corrective measure on the part of the Bush administration to beautify, I mean, its face in the Arab world after the havoc was in Iraq. So
exactly right, exactly right.
You know, it meant to cosmetize, really, the image, you know, of the United States after it was viewed so negatively. Because, you know, Iraq, sure, I mean, people were upset about going into Kuwait, and yes, indeed, you know, there was a trap, by all means, by April Glaspie and others for Saddam, but as you said, this is a subject for another, you know, book to be dealt with. But, you know, Iraq was very important for Palestinians, for the Arabs. I mean, any Arab student could go to completely free, you know, of tuition in Iraq. They didn't have to incur, you know, any expenses. There was excellent education. And so there were many reasons, and people were really upset.
Yes? You used the word trap. Let me remind you of something that you and I wrote. We must have written this shortly after we met. And here we are 20 years from then writing this book together. Here's what we wrote in August 1992 when I was attempting to start a publication called Mideast Realities. It's a few years before the Internet. The Internet came about 1996, and I was able to get MiddleEast.org, and then we started putting things on the Internet. But let me read you this paragraph, because the word trap starts it. We said, the autonomy trap, forcing the Palestinians to accept autonomy, really goes back to Menachem Begin's ideological mentor, Vladimir Jabotinsky, the military founder of revisionist Zionism. More than half a century ago, in 1923, Jabotinsky formulated his call for tightening the noose around the neck of the Palestinians until they would eventually accept, quote-unquote, national autonomy, a status in which they would be surrounded by Jabotinsky's Iron Wall in a way reminiscent of how Indians are confined to reservations in the U.S. and blacks were to be enslaved on tribal homelands in apartheid South Africa. We wrote that in August 1992. I think we were way ahead of the analysis of others, and it sure turned out to be true. Now, not just the Iron Wall, now there's the real wall.
Well, this is really, truly foretelling. If somebody, you know, told me that, I mean, my goodness, this sounds like writing, you know, happening today. Here we were, back then, immediately after the Madrid conference, and before the Oslo Agreement.
A year before Oslo, right, predicting.
Mm-hmm. You know, we saw that happening, okay? So, well, that indeed underscores, you know, the skepticism that I had about Madrid, and obviously that you had. You know, as I said before, to go on with what I was saying before, in December 91, I made a trip to the area. I went to Jordan I was doing research on the impact of the Gulf crisis on Palestinian and Jordanian workers previously working in the Gulf, because over 500,000 Palestinians were thrown out.
That's right.
Of Gulf countries.
That's right. I forget that, right?
You know, and so you can imagine the profundity, the depth of the hurt, I mean, for Palestinians. Anyway, I was doing research, and I met with people, and of course, although I didn't, that was not the objective of my research, to deal with the Madrid conference, but I would ask them also about their view of the Madrid conference. And they would all say, almost by consensus, that this was the beginning of the disaster. This is a continuation of the Nakba. I mean, this is a Nakba in itself.
You know, how interesting for me, you were in North Dakota and going back and forth to Palestine and Jordan. I was in Washington as the delegations would come. Remember, there was a period in which Abdul Shafi headed the negotiating team.
Absolutely, like 12 rounds or 10
from,
rounds.
From after Madrid until the Oslo surprise, which even Abdul Shafi hadn't been told about, and then he resigned in protest when he heard. What a dignified man he was. And I remember the meetings that would take place here, and I would sometimes go, but I always had this feeling of, God, this is really, what in the world are these negotiations about? This is giving the impression that the Americans are actually, quote-unquote, even-handed peace brokers leading to an agreement. And there was just this uneasy feeling that I had, but I couldn't put it in perspective at the time. But I knew I felt alienated. And there we were in August of 92, writing what I just told you, calling it the autonomy trap. And we called it actually Rabin's autonomy trap.
Right.
Shamir had been the prime minister at the time of Madrid, and the imagery was that he was kicking and screaming, and he was forced to come to this conference. I never believed that. I always thought the Israelis and the Americans were setting a trap of some kind, and as you say, the key to it was Palestinians didn't even have their own flag, didn't even sit in their own delegation, so how in the world can they be treated equally? Okay, so there we are. This couple of years takes place, nothing's happening, and then we hear in late August, I think it was, of 93, that there's going to be a historic signing on the White House lawn, that some agreement's been reached in a place called Oslo. And as I said, I once sat down with Abdul Shafi for 3 hours, literally, and heard in detail how he felt, how he got the summons from Arafat to come to Tunis, how he analyzed the situation. And on the day of the White House signing ceremony, which is one of the biggest events, that's political international events that's ever really taken place in Washington, I did the live commentary for Canadian National TV, and I remember expressing considerable doubt that this was going to lead to peace, that we were all being kind of tricked, that we were all being forced to come and witness a marriage that wasn't going to last. I even said that on the program as the White House ceremony took place. And I had learned that Abdul Shafi had refused to come to the White House and had left Washington, and that really alerted me at the time to something being wrong. So jumping ahead to the Oslo conference, where were you at that time, and what were you thinking?
It was a forced marriage. In other words, it can be said that this was a flagrant rape in daylight. At least,
better than my term. It was a daylight rape, and we were all asked to come watch.
That's the problem, exactly. At least, exactly, with the attendance and viewing of so many people all over the world, including us. And I was in Palestine.
You were back in Palestine. You were going back and forth in those days.
In 93. That's a story in itself. In May 93, I was awarded a Fulbright Scholarship to spend the whole year in Palestine. So, as I said, there's a story behind that, because at the beginning, after I was awarded the Fulbright Scholarship, I was told that the scholarship is not going to go through because the situation in Palestine is not safe, and it's very tense. And, I argued, and, there was some intervention by my professor, the late Stanley Anderson, with the Fulbright people, and finally they agreed to revoke that decision of canceling the scholarship, and I was awarded the scholarship. Anyway, so I went to Palestine. I was there in the summer. The atmosphere was one of tension, indeed. There was gloominess. During the summer of 93, there were announcements, one after the other, that the PLO was going bankrupt, that the PLO was unable to pay the bills for its embassies and representative offices all over the world, that the PLO was running out of resources.
There weren't just rumors. That was actually true. That was part of the plot. That was part of how to convince and trick Arafat into what happened.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. So I knew right there and then that something big was to break out, to unfold, because such, news, such rumors, such news would not spread like fire the way it did without serving as a preparation for another move to follow. And indeed, immediately thereafter, the news broke out that there were secret negotiations going on other than the Washington negotiations that were led by Haider Abdeshafi. These were secret negotiations held by the PLO, by Ahmed Khoury, by Abu Mazen, and others in Oslo with some Israeli officials to work out a deal. And indeed, immediately thereafter, we saw that gathering, in the White House garden on September 13, 1993, for the signing of the DOP, the Declaration of Principles. I was watching the news from our house in Dehesha, and I was hurting deeply inside. I wanted my analysis to prove wrong, Mark, and not to be right. I saw the interconnectedness between my skepticism on the eve of the Madrid conference and my affirmation, on the eve of the Oslo signing in Washington, that the Palestinians were in for a very tumultuous ride in the years ahead. The atmosphere was festive in the White House, but on the ground in Palestine, there was so much uncertainty, so much ambivalence. Yes, there were some who went and celebrated and even, raised the olive branch on Israeli military vehicles. And here I'm referring, to somebody like Sharon Schreiber and others, in a way to signify the beginning of a new era. But on the other hand, many Palestinians were also hurting.
There's another factor.
Number one, the shock that engulfed everybody, that there were secret talks going on while Abdel Shafi was leading the negotiations in Washington. Abdel Shafi was widely respected in Palestinian society across different political parties, and people trusted him, trusted his intent, his goals and his intentions, trusted his, him personally, trusted his history. For somebody else to be leading different other talks without the knowledge of Haider Abdel Shafi, certainly,
and nobody knowing what those talks were culminating in, and not seeing
absolutely
any papers and not seeing any written agreements. And in fact, we're living through another period of that now, whereas earlier this year the Palestine papers, because of WikiLeaks, got released, and we see that under the table, the current negotiators, who in fact are the same negotiators who led to Oslo, are giving away the store and doing the same kind of thing they did at that time.
Absolutely. So to me, that really rang, at the alarm bell. I wasn't really comfortable with that, and I saw how Palestinian society was really getting split in a way.
What was the mood in the camp on that day? What was the mood in the following days? From what you've told me, people were following it intensely. They wanted to believe, but you say there was no euphoria. There was no, there was a sense of anxiety, it sounds like you're telling me.
Absolutely. There was anxiety. There was uncertainty. There was disbelief. There was skepticism because of the secrecy in which, the talks were held. Well, especially at a time when Abdel Shafi was leading, the Palestinian delegation in Washington. So all these factors, coalesced, to create a situation of uncertainty in the minds of Palestinians. And in the days and, weeks that followed, of course, people did not see the peace dividend, did not see peace unfolding in the occupied territories. Rather, they saw more roadblocks, more choke points, more hardships on the way. In the years to follow, that Oslo era, proved to be one of the most devastating era for Palestinians in the history of the conflict, where under the rubric of peace, the Israelis used this period to build more settlements, to confiscate more Palestinian land, to imprison more Palestinians, while at the same time giving the image to the outside world that peace was being nurtured and that peace was being built.
And the image
and this
that
is why,
go ahead.
Yeah, and this is why eventually, of course, we had a second intifada in the year 2000, something which we will get to later on.
But, exactly what you said, Rabin, the break-their-bones general, going back to the original war in 1948, where he was involved in the ethnic cleansing, taking his orders from Ben-Gurion, trying to present himself as the peacemaker when, in fact, he was using the Oslo Agreement to... Then the Israelis raced ahead with settlements, raced ahead with the apartheid rules, raced ahead with new restrictions and carving up the area, and the PLO just sort of sat there like a deer in the headlights, not knowing what was going on. The next year, you were in Washington again. We sat down in front of a TV camera then. It was 1994. And we made two TV programs called Mideast Realities. And I remember, I knew I was gloomy at the time. I knew I was pretty cynical and pretty despairing. But I remember, and I think I said it during those programs, and hopefully we can have transcripts in the appendix. I think when we turned the camera off, I said to you, "Oh my goodness, you know, I'm pretty skeptical about this, but you're outdoing me. You don't even think there's going to be economic improvements. You think everything's going to get worse and worse." And I said, "It's in their interest, it's in the Israeli-American interest to at least give those who are cooperating economic benefits to make it appear that something better is happening." And you said, "No, not even that's going to happen."
Yeah, you know, one would wish that we were both wrong, you know. Really, who wants to see this kind of outlook being, you know, translated into facts? Unfortunately, this is what happened. And looking back in retrospect, candidly, Mark, I think those years, 93 to 2000,
I'm going to wait for Hisham to call back because the line's gone dead. So there'll be a little gap here in the recording until he calls back, but I'm going to let the recording go. No need to transcribe this part of it. I'm pretty sure he'll be calling back in just a minute. All right, we'll pick up from right there. Hisham, let me continue with the quote that I was reading you from August 1992, because it also is so telling, and it sort of sets the stage for here you are, you and I are 20 years later, deciding that we have to write this book, we have to tell the stories we know, we have to put everything in perspective, we have to help people understand why the two-state solution is actually dead. And where does that leave us, and where do we go from here? Let's stop talking about dead things and start talking about things that are possible. Here's what we continued in August of 92. We said, and how right we were to use the phrase autonomy trap. I bet we were, I can't say we were the only ones, but I don't recall other people talking about the autonomy trap back then. We said, but even if the autonomy trap springs further shut in coming months and years, it remains certain that the flame of Palestinian and Arab nationalism will remain alive and likely to return at some future date in more unextinguishable form. Those who today appear clever in continuing to suppress and brutalize the Palestinians in their quest for independence and national dignity may find in decades ahead that they have once again turned the rage of the oppressed inward, creating a furor which will explode in future years with compounded vengeance.
Unbelievable.
You know, it's almost a foretaste of, Americans don't quite remember that when Osama bin Laden in the mid-90s started to talk about the American empire and started to criticize American policies, in addition to the troops in Saudi Arabia, he stood up for Palestinian rights. He stood up, he said the Americans are preventing Palestinian freedom and Palestinian independence. And the rise of Hamas, the rise of Hezbollah, the isolation...
And the Intifada itself.
The renewal of the Intifada. Yes, and there we were in August of 92, phrasing things in this way. And here we are 20 years later, phrasing things in a very similar way, in the sense that there isn't going to be any peace agreement. The tricks, the traps, the Israelis don't call it autonomy anymore. They even use the language of statehood. but they only use the word. Everything they do is controlled, co-opted autonomy.
Absolutely. And all that is taking place is indeed, and in fulfillment of an autonomy process. I mean, it has nothing to do with statehood. Statehood means sovereignty, means independence, means control over, resources, over airspace, and so on and so forth. And Palestinians have none of that whatsoever.
It's even worse. In those days, when we were writing what we were writing, you could come from Dehesha to Jerusalem. I could easily, not only I with my American passport, I could go anywhere I wanted, but it was relatively easy to invite people from Ramallah to Jerusalem for a conference, for a lunch, for a dinner. I did it all the time when I was there in those. There wasn't any, there were checks for security, but there were the pass laws. That's not what the Israelis call them. That's what the apartheid people used to call them. The pass laws are very extreme now. Signs restricting who can go where. Most Palestinians can't even go to Jerusalem anymore. It's impossible for them to get there. So,
and thanks to the Oslo era and the Oslo agreement.
There was a symbolic moment that, for me, kind of culminates this period in history. It took place in 95. I believe that's when the Cairo conference took place, and it was kind of a follow-up, a consolidation to what happened at the White House, because they had the Israeli Prime Minister, the American Secretary of State, Yasser Arafat, Mubarak. The whole thing was another big public rape, apparently, and I like your analogy there. And you might know, I expect you know more of the details than I do, but I remember watching it at the time and saying to myself, I have never seen or even read about a moment in history when leaders are all on the stage, when the whole world is focused on them, and one of them is refusing to sign the document that's being put in front of him. They put the document in front of Arafat, and he starts paging through it, and he refuses to sign it. And the cameras went blank. Apparently there was a 10 or 15 minute behind the scenes something or other happening. And finally, he then came out and signed the document he had refused to sign. But what happened at that point? And what a moment of, it's almost like Arafat saying, hey, I'm not going to be raped again.
Well, yes, indeed. I mean, my understanding is that, the Americans and Mubarak were trying to really force something down Arafat's throat, something that he didn't like, to force down his throat some, really altered maps of what he thought was agreed upon, for a deal. And it is also my understanding that when the cameras were off, they went back, inside, and there was a shouting match. And Mubarak was calling Arafat all kinds of names because Mubarak considered that to be a big fiasco for himself if the Cairo agreement is not signed. It will be an embarrassment that he could not get it done, especially at the last moment where the cameras had to be turned off. So he was calling Arafat all kinds of names, and, there was a lot of shouting, and apparently there were promises.
Well, I heard an addition. I heard an addition to that. The same man, it's amazing. On the Palestinian side, the same people who screwed up, the same people who made all this possible, the same people who allowed themselves to be raped and pretended it was a marriage, Arafat, Shaath, Abbas himself. I understood that Nabil jumped up from the audience and took Arafat behind the curtain, and that he worked him over as well. And I can just see Hosni there screaming and shouting. I think it was the Secretary of State for the Americans. It wasn't the President. Is that right?
I think so.
But nevertheless, what a moment in history to culminate this period. It's almost as if the symbolism of the Arab leader saying, this isn't working out like I expected. I can't take it anymore. I just won't sign this anymore. I don't care if the whole world's watching. I'm being tricked and I'm being abused. And my people, you know, for all of Arafat's failings, he died after years of tremendous pressures, after the house arrest, after the bombings in Ramallah. And I think you and I agree, which we'll get to in another chapter, it was really a stealth assassination. But in the end, he refused to sign further documents. He refused to go down this road. That's why the Israelis eventually isolated him and got rid of him. Is that
absolutely?
Is that
absolutely
the way you see it in general as well?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think, you know, Arafat had this inner conflict. I mean, all along, on the one hand, you know, believing that he can accomplish something for his people through these negotiations and through these agreements, while on the other hand, seeing the occupation further unfolding and further deepening on the ground. And this was a real, you know, inner conflict for him, and finally he resolved it, but perhaps it was a little bit too late when he refused to sign any more deals and agreements and when he stood his ground. And, of course, that's when the Israelis turned completely, you know, against him. I mean, they all have always been against him. They tried to kill him and assassinate him while in Beirut, while in Tunis. You may remember, you know, at one point they launched an airstrike on his compound in Tunis in order to kill him. And were it not for the fact that he was jogging at that moment, he would have been killed in the airstrike.
Well, this brings us to a new chapter because then Rabin was assassinated. Then, a year later, I think, Bibi Netanyahu came to power. And although there's a consistency in Israeli policies, there's a different presentation and a different image with the two major wings of Zionism. At that time, it was still Labor Zionism and Revisionist Zionism. So that opened up another period. Plus, in the United States, you had the neocons organizing for something called the Project for the New American Century, and the American Jewish neocons, because most of them are Jewish and most of them are right-wing Zionists, they were telling Netanyahu in open memos at the time to end the Oslo peace process and make sure that there's no chance of a real Palestinian state. So how about we'll pick up with that in the next chapter?
Yes, indeed.